From downtown Milwaukee, welcome to Money Talk with Bob Landis. Each week, professional advisors from Landis & Company Investments discuss the latest financial developments, offering timely insight and long-term perspective.
This is Money Talk for November 19th, 2021. The Sunday afternoon, the Packers are in Minnesota with the Vikings, and your Milwaukee Bucks have four, count them, four home games this week. If you ever had any doubt that the world is coming to an end, let's settle that right now. It is. In the Thames River in London, scientists have discovered poisonous sharks. What, regular sharks weren't scary enough? In a Spanish nature preserve on a Mediterranean island, so many tourists are having sex, they're ruining the beach. Sounds like you got to really be careful where you step. And speaking of beaches and not the Bette Midler movie, Denmark spends $150,000 monthly to clean seaweed and plastic from its beaches, then dumps it back into the ocean. Is this some kind of weird job security thing? Let's hear it for our educational system. 40% of American kids think hot dogs are vegetables. I guess that would make ketchup a fruit. A terminally ill man in London drove through a red light and mooned the traffic camera. His reasoning for such a brazen act? He's terminally ill, and it was on his bucket list. So good for him. And today we have another example of irony. Sweden's ice hotel, which is literally all ice, has smoke detectors. On the podcast today, we have Kyle Tedding, Art Rothschild, Paige Ratke, Joel Dreesing, and wrapping up the week, here's Bob Landis.
Thanks, Max. Mixed results for the markets this week. NASDAQ, S&P, the broader markets finished higher while the Dow sold off. NASDAQ added 1.2%, 196 points this week. Record highs on Thursday, closed at 16,057. The broader markets, S&P 500 also hit a record on Thursday, up 15 points this week, 0.3% advance. We closed at 46.98 for the broader markets. Dow Jones Industrial Average did shed 498 points, giving up 1.4%. We closed at the belly this afternoon in New York with the Dow finishing the week 35,602. Still, what a great run for the year. Dow's up 18, S&P up 26, NASDAQ closed behind up 25 for the year. You know, Kyle, this is the point in the year when forecasts for next year start coming out. About everyone I've read is on the bearish side. Pretty easy call to make after how much money's been made in stocks the last 3 years. So I thought what we'd do here to kick off the show today is, you know, go through the bearish arguments, go through the bullish arguments. Keep in mind, everybody, that as you listen to this, take this with a grain of salt. It's almost impossible to predict short-term movements in stocks. I rarely do. But having said that, there are some people that I respect that are coming out and saying, hey, you know, it really could be the ninth inning here. We may go into extra innings, but we're not in the beginning of the ball game. So, you know, let's start off with the bearish side. PEs are high. The only two times the CAPE ratio has been higher, 1929 and 1999, those didn't end well. Market cap as a percentage of GDP, right? So you add up the capitalization of all publicly traded stocks divided into GDP, that's at an all-time high. Inflation, so we don't think inflation is going to stick around much past early next year. Could be wrong. Hard to hire people these days. Supply chain disruptions. On the bullish side, earnings are really strong now, right? Really strong. Yeah, when we finished up most of the third quarter earnings, they were higher than what the street expected. Vast majority outperformed what the analysts thought. Number two, we've got really strong momentum. I mean, it's sides, you know, stepping a little bit here last week and this week, but momentum overall has been strong since the beginning of October. We've had significant GDP expansion, right? Pretty hard to argue with 6% plus GDP that we saw early in the year. Pent-up demand, you know, the way I like to explain that one to clients is we all got shut into our houses and half of us got fed up looking at that ratty couch all the time. that everybody decided to rush out and get new furniture. It's amazing to me that retail on stuff, not services, but stuff, is up 18% from pre-pandemic levels. It's a big number, and it's unprecedented in modern history. Also on the bullish side, rates are still low. You can meow all you want about inflation, but the point is the 10-year is roughly 1.5%. You know, that's so low historically. Average is 5.5 or nowhere near that. So trust the street. Trust what the financial markets are saying there. And then finally, we've got supportive government policy. I thought it was interesting. David Brooks, in an opinion piece in this morning's New York Times, quoted a woman from Morgan Stanley that said, give or take, that for every $100 billion of infrastructure spending, you're increasing GDP by 0.1%. So think about that, right? $1 trillion plan, a lot of money. You know, the way Morgan Stanley is interpreting it is that, you know, give or take, you could potentially be tacking on a full percentage point to GDP, largest infrastructure program in over 10 years. It's high time that we rebuilt the electric grid, let alone all these crumbling roads and bridges that we have. Biggest package in a really, really long time, which is kind of surprising, and that'll pay back for years. So the good side of the story is all sorts of nice things are happening. Bad side, you know, stocks are expensive. Typically stocks are volatile, moving into rate increases that we'll see next year. So it's not a good time to be aggressive, but I don't think it's a good time to be out of the market either.
You know, what I think is so interesting about that conversation, Bob, is maybe the last piece you mentioned, and that's talking about stock market volatility. We tend to see, as CAPE ratios, as prices overall rise, that volatility tends to return in a lot of areas it hadn't been in the past. And so I think, you know, as we talk about what the future looks like, tempering expectations is an important thing. And I think plenty of check marks in the bullish column, some check marks in the bearish column as well. And I think what's left then is to talk about what investors should really be thinking about as we, you know, prepare for the end of 2021 and enter into 2022. And what's left is, I think, some potential for volatility. What's left, I think, is a little bit more tempered expectations for, you know, the near term. But, you know, I want to move beyond just simply what the next year looks like when we talk about the future. I want to move beyond simply, you know, what some of those simple forecasts are. I think incredibly important to understand what the risks are, and you do such a good job of outlining what they are and what you mentioned earlier. But I think I am considerably optimistic at some things as we look beyond just next year, as you look at what has been a substantial a technology shift or technological shift in the past few years that's made its way to corporate profitability. I think, you know, one of the big items in the bullish category for me is this idea that we are running incredibly lean in inventory in some of the most expensive purchases that are made either on a corporate side or on an individual side. And so, you know, we could see an inventory build that, you know, I think helps both GDP and corporate profitability as we look ahead. And so, yeah, I am certainly concerned about some of those items you mentioned on the bearish column. But I think, you know, if we can navigate some of those near-term risks, if we can continue to grow earnings at a rate that, you know, can support stock prices at their current level, I think it allows us to turn to some of those longer-term views. It allows us to be a bit more optimistic about the future. And of course, understanding that we've got to get through those short-term concerns, you know, just to get to that longer-term view.
Paige, what do you think?
Yeah, I think all the things that you said, all the things that Kyle said, are really good points. Obviously, looking at some of the biggest questions that I've been continuing to get lately continues to be surrounding inflation and government spending. But as we've discussed, this is expected. When you have that level of pent-up demand and things open up and you open the floodgates the way that we've seen, you would expect to see some rise in prices. But what's been interesting is, despite all of that, retailers, specifically big retailers, have revenue growth that is outpacing those inflation numbers. So typically when we look at inflation as a bad thing, it's because that will cause those consumers to stop spending their money or put off some of those big purchases. And we've still not seen any of that. And so what that tells me is that consumers at this point in time are not yet deterred by the higher prices, which if that's the case, the impact on the economy won't actually be as outsized as I think most people are concerned about.
Joel, to underscore Paige's point, Commerce Department reported this week retail sales up 1.7% in October. That's a big number. Obviously, they didn't let higher prices get in their shopping way.
Yeah, Bob, you know, exactly what Paige was saying is that, and, you know, your reference to pent-up demand before, too. You know, and we saw a week ago the University of Michigan Consumer Sentiment Report about how consumers are really worried about inflation, and yet we're seeing these retail numbers, the Commerce Department report, and based on that, the amount of money that consumers are spending in the economy right now is up by $112 billion from where it was just before the pandemic. The PNC Financial had some estimates this week that consumers have something like $2 trillion more to spend than they had before the recession. So you've got that pent up demand with the money to spend it, and we're seeing more things like this.
Joel, as you know, the Labor Department reported this week first-time claims for unemployment insurance finally fell below the 300,000 level at 268. That's the lowest number in the pandemic. Shows that layoffs aren't really an issue, and we're back to pre-pandemic labor numbers.
That's right. And it just for historical purposes, I mean, if you go back to the Great Recession, it took 5 years to get back below that 300,000 level.
It took a year and a half.
Yeah, right. Yeah. But the other side of that is we're still about 30% ahead of where we were just before the pandemic. So we're seeing a lot of our indicators show that we're near or above the levels that we were at on a good side before the pandemic started, except for labor. You know, those, even though we've made a lot of progress on those unemployment insurance claims, we're still 30,000 a week, you know, above what we were just before the pandemic. So we still have some work to do there.
Art, you've been at this a long time. You manage a lot of money here. Well, what's your take on things now?
Well, again, I have to agree with the fact that you guys are focusing on both the pros and the cons. There are some concerns we always face and always have to face. One of my favorite Wall Street terms is a bull market climbs a wall of worries. So you've definitely identified some of the worries, but I still think there are concerns about COVID. They're having shutdowns now in Austria and parts of Germany, and the market, I think, has responded to that a little bit. But on the flip side of that, over time, stocks always go higher. And again, the bull market climbs a wall of worry. And another old saying, buy when there's blood in the streets. So as Paige has taught us over time, you should expect corrections periodically. And when those happen, we sold off in September, we came back in October. So I feel very good about where we are. I feel even better about where we're going. As you indicated, you mentioned pent-up demand. We are, as the economic statistics have suggested, we're beyond where the economy was before the pandemic started. And there's still people on the sidelines not spending. And as you've pointed out on a regular basis, the bottlenecks are going to, you know, abate. And we will have more goods moving through the system. We have more raw materials and more components like chips to go into cars and things. And so I am a little beyond cautiously optimistic about what lies ahead. And I'm going to come back to one more thing, what we do here for a living. We're not betting on what's going to happen tomorrow, the next day, the next week, the next month. We know there are opportunities in value stocks, which are undervalued relative to growth stocks. As Kyle alluded to, there's tremendous opportunities down the road. We always use bonds to smooth out the ride, and over the decades, as you suggested, that I've been here, and the 35 years you've been in this building, let alone in the business, beyond that, we've always made money over long periods of time. So we have tremendous confidence that what we're doing works and will continue to.
I think one of the takeaway points for anybody listening to this podcast is it's very challenging, almost impossible to predict the future, and we're not even trying to do that. You know, we're trying to articulate the good side of the story, the bad side of the story. But the point specifically is stay balanced in your approach because it's really hard. I mean, as bizarre as this statement might sound, I never heard of COVID a couple of years ago. I mean, think how bizarre that statement is. Never saw it coming. What wasn't until Wuhan, China, created some patients that it showed up on my radar screen. And it was less than 2 years ago. So stay balanced. You know, make sure your portfolio is close to a 60-40 mix, because the academics are pretty convinced you get much past 60%. As we said constantly on this program over the years, your risk line keeps going up, but your return line flattens out. So don't try to game the system. Don't try to think you can predict. We can't. You can't either. But what you can do is focus on stuff you can control. And one of the things you can control is the stock bond mix. Don't look at your statements and say, I don't want to sell that. That was my best winner. Yeah, well, that's not really the point. It was get back to the balance, because predicting the future is really hard most days. And I would say coming out of COVID, it's pretty near impossible. So let's go back to a couple of other issues here. You know, Joel, I saw that housing starts fell 0.7% in October. Tells you that maybe the housing market is cooling off a little bit. You know, the builders will say they can't find workers, they can't find supplies, whatever. Housing starts are going down.
That's right, Bob. You know, and again, I mean, earlier in the year, we reached peaks that we haven't seen since 2007, both in housing starts and permits. And we've receded a bit since then, but we're still above where we were, going into the pandemic, and there's still that pent up demand there. And one of the things that I found interesting was that the completion of single family houses went down 17% from where it was in March, but it's still on pace with early 2008. But just that. Contraction since March kind of speaks to probably some of the concerns about labor and supplies.
Joel, I think it's just an important thing to point out, too, that we're comparing the levels that we have right now to those in 2007. And let's not forget that 2007 was just before the housing crash that ended up leading to the Great Recession. The big difference between now and then is that then mortgages that were being issued to lots of families were very questionable. There were lots of concerns about whether they were even going to be able to pay them back, and it was nearly impossible not to get approved for some of those really high mortgages. That's not what we're seeing right now. People are buying homes sometimes with cash. Yes, mortgage rates are low, but there's a much stronger regulation on who is receiving those mortgages and whether or not they're able to pay it back. So even though we're looking at those 2007 numbers as a comparison, the strength of the balance sheets of those buying those homes is much stronger.
Paige, that's a good point. And just a reminder that just before we went into this last recession, the really short, severe recession caused by COVID, the economy was pretty strong. People were doing pretty well.
You know, it's mathematically impossible longer term for home prices to go up faster than wages. Everybody tends to forget that. You really can't sustain 15-20% increases in home prices without wages going up eventually to match that. I mean, there are just too many of us in the United States. And collectively, as a group, you can't justify higher home prices. I mean, year to year you can, but longer term you can't. You parallel home prices with wage growth in the United States, it's almost dead on parallel. And so just common sense says that the increase in home prices has to level off unless wages explode to the upside. All in all, we've had a wonderful year. The third of 3 years in a row of very high stock prices. It's always a time to be cautious. You know, we think about defense as well as offense. Kyle, I want to end this by just having a quick conversation about asymmetrical risk, which is a really important concept at this point in time. And folks, this sounds complicated. It's not. You really want to measure, you know, how much risk are you taking relative to the reward that you get. And we all know that growth stocks, as a general rule, have higher cash flow than value stocks. And we know that when you try to figure out present value of future cash flow, you have to discount by a higher rate. It tends to affect the growth stocks more. So when you look at asymmetrical risk, when you're looking at trimming your portfolio, you want to rebalance down somewhere near a 60%. you know, think of the stock categories that tend to fall the most in a downturn. And that's where you want to reduce your risk. Your advisor here more than capable of stepping you through that. But, you know, kind of an important point.
Yeah, I think, Bob, what I love so much about that conversation, the conversation about symmetry, is it's at the foundation, it's the heart of what we have always done for investors, is trying to find ways to create asymmetrical positive returns, right? Get more return on the upside than what you participate in on the downside. And there's a small number of ways you can do that, allocation being the biggest one, right? That if you take some of the stock off the table, you put it in something that behaves a little differently than the stock market behaves, you can cut a lot of the downside out of the market when the S&P or when some stock index sells off, but you can still participate to a large extent in the upside. And so that's, you know, one example of asymmetry, right? Getting a little bit more on the upside than what you get on the downside. But it works its way even into the individual investments we select, right? This idea that we want to find investments that have more potential upside than they do downside. When you look at active management, it's one of the absolute best tools they have at their disposal, that they can shy away from a lot of those positions that represent excess downside without the potential upside, right? We often talk about, active management outperforming indexes. It's probably the wrong conversation. When it falls in terms of a market like we've had this year, what we really care about is how does active management do when the world is falling apart? Because that's, I think, really when they have proven that they earn their mettle, right? That ultimately, if you can lose a little bit less, if you can avoid having to dig out of a more significant hole, long term, that's going to work out in your favor. And so, you look at an index that's going to participate in meme stocks, it's going to participate in any number of stocks that are significantly overvalued. Active managers can choose either to avoid them entirely or to reduce what kind of weighting they have in their portfolios as a way to try to say, okay, this represents outside risk to the negative, and there just isn't enough potential return here for us to want to stick around in it. And so I think, you know, the key is not just in the way you allocate it, but in what you choose to put in your portfolios. Every one of those decisions should be focusing on that concept of asymmetrical risk.
And Kyle, I think the point in a nutshell, and I'm not sure most people really get this, that the better active managers that outperform the indices do it mostly on the downside, that because of cash positions in actively managed funds, pretty challenging for a lot of them to outperform the indexes on the way up. But where they earn their keep is on the downside. So we look at lofty valuations in certainly the U.S. markets. You look at the asymmetrical risk. This is when the active managers really shine. So yeah, we'll be talking more about asymmetrical risk on the podcast next week. Well, folks, that's the end of yet another Money Talk. We enjoyed doing the program. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week.
Thank you for listening to Money Talk with Bob Landis. If you have a financial question you want answered on next week's show, email it to moneytalk@landis.com. To keep informed throughout the week, visit our Money Talk page at landis.com.